Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. This is Wayne Carroll of the SEC Historical Society on April 19th, 2006, with Ethiopis Tufara of the Office of International Affairs. Ethiopis, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us today. Before we get into your arrival on the scene at the SEC, I'd like to just set the stage and mention a couple of facts about the office itself. My understanding is the office was set up in 1989 under Chairman Breeden, and that was also the beginning of the International Institute around that time. And as we speak, the 16th Institute is actually underway. The roots or origins of the office lie actually in enforcement, as I understand it. There is an oral history of Michael Mann, who was the first director of the office, also in the Virtual Museum, and he came from the enforcement side, and apparently a lot of the early efforts of the office were on the enforcement side. Approximately 10 years later, you transitioned to the SEC, and please let us know how that transpired.
Yes, prior to joining the SEC in 1999 as an assistant director in the Office of International Affairs, I had served as one of the counsel to Chairperson Vaughan at the CFTC. I'd had a fair amount of contact with the Office of International Affairs at the SEC by virtue of the time I'd spent in the Enforcement Division at the CFTC, where we had worked with OIA at the SEC on a number of cross-border enforcement issues. We interestingly met abroad as part of international meetings where enforcement issues were discussed, and given that we both, the CFTC and the SEC, were representing the United States, our views and our interests were aligned. And in that context, I got to know the operation of the SEC's Office of International Affairs and the people who were here. And at some point, it seemed to make sense for me to join the office. When I joined in 99, the office was about 20 people strong. And, you know, 10 years on from its creation, the primary focus of the office remained enforcement, and that is true even today, several years beyond 1999. By that point, I think the Office of International Affairs and the SEC had gotten to be quite good at the information sharing business, as I tend to call it. Many of the early issues and kinks associated with cross-border information sharing had been worked out. There were numerous bilateral MOUs that had been negotiated and concluded with our principal counterparts from around the world, and in most instances, through those MOUs and through other mechanisms, the office was able to collect information to help build the investigative records for the Division of Enforcement cases that had international components to them. That, as I said, you know, remains the meat and potatoes of this office. But there has been somewhat of an evolution both in the issues that we deal with in the cross-border enforcement context, as well as the mechanisms that we use for cross-border assistance. Taking the issues first, you know, in the beginning it was about information sharing, and in 89 when this office was created, there were few regulators around the world, including the SEC, that had a statutory authority to compel information on behalf of a foreign counterpart. By 1999, many jurisdictions had actually gone out and gotten that legislative authority, the SEC included. The new frontier has to do with other kinds of assistance. In terms of, for example, asset freezes, we spend a fair amount of time now and quite a few resources tracking down the assets of defrauded investors, where those assets have moved beyond the borders of the United States, and figuring out ways to freeze those assets in the jurisdiction where they're located, and the interest of having those assets available to satisfy a judgment we hopefully will obtain at the end of our enforcement action. That is proving to be an interesting and complex area, and one where we think we as regulators around the world should start thinking about whether or not we should get legislative authority to get asset freezes on behalf of one another in the way that we now are able to get information, compel information on behalf of one another. That's changes in substance, and that's just one example of the kinds of issues we encounter in the cross-border context today. The mechanisms have changed somewhat. As I said earlier, we have numerous, close to 30 bilateral cooperative enforcement arrangements with counterparts from around the world, and they have served us very well. But about 2001, we realized as a community, and here I'm talking about the international regulatory community, that if we were to have a multilateral MOU, it actually might serve a symbolic function in a couple of ways. It would serve to articulate what we as the regulatory community felt was the minimum that regulators should be able to do to provide assistance to one another in enforcement cases. And so you would have that articulation in a way that I don't think we'd had before. But also by virtue of having this multilateral MOU out there, known about, it would create an incentive and a momentum towards joining, and joining only being possible if you could meet that minimum requirement. And it has actually had that effect. I mean, the MOU was finalized, I think, sometime in mid-2002 with, I think, the original signatories. We must have been about 8 strong. We're now close to 30 strong, and there are a number of applications. I think there are like 40 applications in the pipeline. And that means we have 60 countries that are going to be in the position to, at the very least, do a couple of things. They will be able to collect information from banks and brokerage firms. They'll be able to compel that information, share that with a foreign counterpart, and that foreign counterpart will be able to use it for their investigations, their proceedings, and share it with the criminal authorities in their jurisdiction. That would be a very different landscape from what we had in 99, and certainly what we had in 89. That's the way in which the International Enforcement Program, one of the ways in which the International Enforcement Program here at the SEC's Office of International Affairs has evolved.
Mm-hmm. Do the bilateral agreements retain some relevance?
They do retain relevance in that our bilateral agreements require more. The multilateral MOU is a minimum, and at a minimum there's an expectation that you'd be able to get bank and brokerage records and you share them. But under our bilateral arrangements, we get ISP records, we get records from telephone companies. There's a world of information beyond simply bank and brokerage records that we're able to get under our bilateral MOUs, and so it still remains a useful tool, and indeed we will only now negotiate bilateral MOUs with jurisdictions that can do much more than simply get bank and brokerage records for us.
I imagine that the focus of information being sought at the time the bilateral agreements were being negotiated was pretty much focused on the paper world at the time. So what you have in your own files are files to which you had access perhaps at other agencies. I imagine the fulfilling any kind of request was kind of an either-or situation, either you had access or not. Has technology, say, increased the expectations that you may have to go and do some digging from third parties in order to fulfill requests for information?
Well, interestingly, that expectation was there from the beginning. The expectation was that you'd be able to compel information. When we went out and got 21A2 of the Exchange Act, 21A2 basically says we will compel information from anybody in the United States if it's requested of us and it's relevant to an investigation into potential securities violations being conducted by a counterpart. That meant getting information that was not necessarily in our files, that was available through some third party, and issuing a subpoena upon them for that information. Given that that was contemplated, it was also contemplated that we share information that's in our files. So that has always been an expectation. The truth is, for our counterparts, things have changed somewhat. I mean, we have the broadest powers when it comes to information sharing. When we started out, there were jurisdictions that could, for example, only get information from the regulated community and share that with us. Many of those regulators are now in a better position in that they can get information not only from the regulated community but from others in their jurisdiction and share that with us. Another difference between us and our counterparts and between then and now is the need for testimony. I think when we first did MOUs and sought information from our counterparts from around the world early on in the 80s and 90s, we were seeking, as you say, documentary information. Today, it's fair to say that more often than was certainly the case 10 years ago, we're seeking for assistance in compelled testimony, so asking our counterparts to compel a statement from somebody in their jurisdiction, a statement that we would then use as part of our investigative record.
You mentioned that some of the kinks were worked out in the early years, but I imagine certain areas such as compelled testimony, some kinks may resurface, such as some of the structural differences in the common law versus civil law approaches to testimony.
Absolutely. And indeed, there are kinks to be worked out among the common law jurisdictions. Yes, most of our continental counterparts and most jurisdictions that have civil law systems, the regulators there aren't unable to compel a statement. They can take a statement, but they can't issue subpoenas and force somebody to give a statement. So we have to figure out how we get statements under oath in that context. But interestingly enough, we have issues in getting compelled statements in common law jurisdictions whereby, for example, if you ask for the UK FSA or for the Canadian regulators, provincial regulators, to compel a statement on your behalf, an issue arises in that the right against self-incrimination attaches at different points under their system as opposed to our system. In the UK and Canada and Australia, the right against self-incrimination attaches at the time of trial, which means when a regulator compels your statement, you have to give the statement. The statement can't be used in a criminal proceeding, but you have to give your statement. In the United States, that's not the case. It attaches at the time of the asking of the question. So as soon as we ask you the question, if you believe it's going to incriminate you, you can assert your right against self-incrimination. So we find ourselves in these situations. We go to a common law jurisdiction. We ask them to compel the testimony. The person whose testimony is being compelled will say, well, wait a minute. I'm giving you a statement, and once I give it to you, the U.S. authorities can use that at trial because I've given it, and I haven't asserted my right against self-incrimination, and you won't let me because in the U.K. it attaches at a different point. It requires some creativity on our part, and we do work with our counterparts in trying to find ways to make sure that statements are taking into account the rights that an individual has, both in the jurisdiction where the statement's being taken as well as the United States.
It appears that the office is involved in many more areas aside from enforcement, as evidenced by the multilateral policy initiatives. So you're now faced or dealing with issues related to accounting, market regulation on a global level. How has that impacted the work of the office?
Well, it's made it difficult for us to cover such a broad waterfront. As we've taken on more international regulatory policy work, as I like to call it, we've had to take pretty much the same number of attorneys and other professionals we have here and apply their time and their skills to that many more issues. But you're right, there's been an evolution in the issues that this office addresses where I think, say 10, 15 years ago, 70-80% of the work was enforcement related. Today, I'd say, 50 to 60% of it is enforcement related, and another good 30% of it is what I call international regulatory policy, where, that involves two things. It involves representing this agency and international organizations that are developing principles, standards, papers, best practices intended to have some application in the securities market, and making sure that those principles and those standards reflect our views and are consistent with the regulatory approach in the United States. And there are a plethora of those organizations, as I'm sure there's IOSCO, which is extremely well known, the International Organization of Securities Commissions, but we also participate in the Council of Securities Regulators of the Americas and the Financial Action Task Force and in the OECD. That is a big resource application for the Office of International Affairs. The other part of regulatory policy, international regulatory policy, is looking at the impact of SEC rulemaking beyond the borders of the United States informing and advising the Commission and the staff of that impact, areas where we might be creating some conflict of law, and identifying ways to mitigate conflict, if at all possible. It requires some understanding of foreign regimes, legal regimes, and foreign regulatory philosophies. It is something really that has burgeoned, I would say, since the passage of Sarbanes-Oxley, where we were confronted with a statute that had to be implemented within a period of time that had application to anybody who was participating in the U.S. market, domestic or foreign, yet recognizing that some of the provisions could conflict with provisions that apply to foreign private issuers and foreign accounting firms that were present in the U.S. Now, that's not to say that these sorts of issues didn't get dealt with prior to 1999. Indeed, the international disclosure standards, which I think are a major milestone in the international regulatory community and a major contribution of IOSCO, was something that happened. I think they were finalized in 1998. And those sorts of issues got dealt with by this office in the past as well. But I think the increasing globalization of markets has required that we do more of that sort of work here in the Office of International Affairs. It necessarily, I wouldn't say changes our relationship with the other divisions and offices here, but I think we are becoming a more important service outpost in that we now have as a client not only the Division of Enforcement, not only the commissioners and the chairman, but in addition we have as clients the Office of the Chief Accountant, Division of Market Regulation, Division of Investment Management. It is their rules that we're looking at and providing advice on in terms of the implications for the rest of the world.
I guess the flip side of this development in relation to SEC rulemaking and legislation is that not only are you giving more thought to the impact on foreign participants, but they themselves are at times actively engaged, involved in the process, be it in the public comment process or in other ways.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, there are a couple of things there. Absolutely, there is more active commentary and engagement on the part of the foreign market participant community, and we spend some time reviewing their comments when they're in writing, interacting with them, meeting with them to hear what their issues are, and understanding what their concerns are. That's directly with the market participants. We also have started engaging in what we call regulatory dialogues, and these are bilateral in nature, so we have in these dialogues with China, Japan, Europe, Committee of European Securities Regulators, and the objective there is to sit down and talk about the regulatory concerns we each have, find out which ones we have in common, and by virtue of that discussion, hopefully move towards solutions and regulatory approaches that converge as opposed to diverge, given that, the market participants are global in their activity and global in their presence. Regulation is national by definition, and the only way to make this work is for us to coordinate and collaborate and cooperate as regulators. Now that has become, again, another resource application for us, in addition to enforcement and participation in these international organizations and reviewing rulemaking. We also engage in these dialogues to inform ourselves of what the issues are that arise from our regulation, and also to try and devise solutions that that minimize conflict.
As part of that process, what kind of impact does that have on staffing issues? Do you now look for people with some understanding of foreign legal systems, foreign market and corporate structures? Is that part of your training program, et cetera?
Yeah, it's. I think the profile of the staff hasn't changed all that much. I mean, we end up recruiting and attracting people who are versatile and who have broad-ranging interest and broad-ranging skills. It's an interesting skill set that you need to do well in this office. There are elements of diplomacy, legal analysis, cultural sensitivity. You can imagine the kinds of qualities you would need to deal in the environment in which we deal. Many of the people who are attracted to this office do have backgrounds whereby they've been exposed to regulations in other jurisdictions and foreign legal systems. It's not a prerequisite, nor are language skills, although I think just because of who we are, we end up attracting those sorts of people. I've got a staff of about 25 people now, and I'd say 10 of those people have language skills, and the other 15 don't, but that is in no way a handicap. What's more important is really, cultural sensitivity, sense of diplomacy, good legal analysis, good understanding of how laws match up against one another in a cross-border context. Those are more important skills than language skills.
Have some of the developments that we've covered, has that impacted the overall role of the office within the SEC?
Yeah, I think it has. I think we, as I said, you know, with the passage of Sarbanes-Oxley, we were asked to do more of the more analysis of the impact that our rules would have outside of the United States in a systematic way, which was not, I don't think, the practice before. And so, yeah, and that has led to people asking us to do more and more of that. So the role has changed, of the office within the SEC has changed considerably.
One of the early areas of the office, technical assistance, continues to be quite important, but I imagine the type of assistance and the form of assistance has changed over time.
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. The two institutes remain the foundation of our technical assistance program. We still have the Spring and Fall Institute, the Spring Institute being the two-week institute, where we have in attendance regulators from emerging markets, and where the program is what I'd like to call securities regulation from A to Z, put on by a faculty of senior staff from the SEC and practitioners from the U.S. and elsewhere sometimes, and Wall Street. And the Fall Institute being more about enforcement and market oversight, catering more to developed markets, again, with a faculty from the SEC and practitioners in Wall Street. That remains the foundation of the technical assistance program. And I don't think that will change any time in the near future. But as you point out, we are now also doing a lot of what I term bilateral and regional training. Bilateral training involving requests from a particular jurisdiction to come and put on a program on a particular topic, whether it be broker-dealer inspections, whether it be market surveillance, whether it be accounting and corporate governance. Those programs, usually 3 or 4 days long, involving about 3 or 4 people from the SEC and sometimes from the NASD and elsewhere. And then increasingly we've been doing regional programs, trying to get more bang for our buck, where we will put on a training program of the kinds that I described in the bilateral context, but where we would ask the host to actually open up the training program to other regulators from the region, so that we're reaching a broader audience than simply the regulators in one jurisdiction. And on a yearly basis, I'd say we do anywhere from 6 to 12 of these bilateral / regional programs. And they are, I suppose, an evolution in the technical assistance program here at the SEC. And indeed, I think we have to turn away requests. There are so many of them.
Has there been any kind of geographic shift to the technical assistance? In the 90s, there were a lot of economies converting from a socialist model to a market economy, and there were all kinds of programs going on in Eastern Europe. How has that developed since that time?
It's a very perceptive question. I think that's absolutely right. In the beginning, when this office was first established, the focus, as dictated by historical events, was really Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. I think over the course of time, it has shifted with an initial shift towards Asia. Starting in 98, we started expending a fair amount of resource in China and other Asian markets. And then a shift in the early 2000s toward the Middle East, and that continues. There's a lot of interest from Middle Eastern jurisdictions who are for training. Now our attention, of course, is taken up by the big jurisdictions, India. We are doing a lot of technical assistance there, and we continue to do a lot of technical assistance in China. Because our enforcement cases have led to needing the help of countries within this hemisphere, we more recently have decided that we need to expend a little bit more time and effort in Latin America and the Caribbean. So we put on, over the course of the past couple of years, programs in Brazil, in Ecuador, in Barbados, in other countries in the region. And I expect we will, that's a trend that will continue. This hemisphere has become more important for us, both from an enforcement standpoint as well as a regulatory standpoint. And lastly, because we have historically neglected the continent, we have decided to make the effort to try and provide some training in Africa, and we held a very first training program in Africa, in Abuja, Nigeria, last year, and expect to do another one in East Africa sometime soon.
And this is also an area where the impact of technology has been felt. You have a web-based training program in order to leverage resources. And how has that impacted such programs?
Technology, as you know, is terrific. It makes things easier. It makes things cheaper. The web-based programs allow us to reach regulators around the world without expending the cost of travel, without expending the cost of time spent in a country. There's something as simple as the materials we prepare for the institute. My paralegal staff will tell you that 5 years ago, preparing for an institute, putting together the materials was a huge headache in terms of photocopying and binders and the like. Today we put it all on a CD-ROM. It has made it possible for us to do more with less. We continue to look for ways to use technology to promote the objectives of the program.
I imagine that in keeping with globalization, the ripple effect of developments in the U.S. Is a lot quicker than it was in the past. So, say, developments in mutual funds or hedge funds here quickly are found in other jurisdictions as well. Has that led to, say, more specific or detailed requests for assistance and quicker assistance?
I'm not sure it's led to more detailed requests for assistance or quicker assistance. It has led to an increasing call for discussion about the regulatory response to the prevalence of hedge funds and the breadth of hedge fund activity, for example. And by that I mean, as what happens in our markets has this ripple effect beyond our markets, what you see happening shortly thereafter is a request by our counterparts to sit down and talk about how we, the SEC, intend to respond to a particular market development, given that they're seeing the same thing and wanting to be sure that we are moving in the same direction in the interest of avoiding market participants arbitraging the regulatory systems. So whereas I think in the beginning, for example, of IOSCO, we talked more about enforcement and more about what I would term generic issues like, what are the basic disclosure requirements that should be imposed upon companies. Today you'll find IOSCO delving into things like credit rating agencies, delving into securities analyst conflicts of interest, and you'll note that each of these things are topics that were hot topics in the United States, and then all of a sudden we're having a discussion and developing some sort of standards, practices, best practices or principles. And that's what the impact of our market has led to is more calls for coordinated regulatory responses to those market problems.
Before we conclude the interview, are there any other additional comments you'd like to make?
I'm not sure. I think it's the office probably is different than it was when it was first created in 1999 in certain respects, but in many ways it remains the same. Enforcement is really the driver here, and what we spend the most time and effort working on. The number of requests that we make for enforcement assistance on a yearly basis and the number of requests we receive does nothing but increase every year. We're now up to, I think, 400 requests made and about the same received. That takes a fair amount of time, but it really is what makes it's the source of the strength of the relationships we have with our counterparts. It's our willingness to help each other pursue wrongdoing and take action against wrongdoing that has led to this tight regulatory community, international regulatory community that you see. In that way, it's no different from what you would have seen in 1989.
That could be one of the reasons why one of the speakers at this year's Institute said that you have one of the best jobs at the Commission.
I would not contradict that speaker.
Ethiopis Tafara, thanks very much again for taking the time to speak with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.